And David has come around once again on this Sunday evening, October 15th, 2006. A little bit of Nellie McKay there, opening our 10:30 pre-show, because I'm Dave Lefkowitz, the host of Dave's Gone By, which starts at 11 p.m., but for a few weeks now we've been doing a pre-show, a special 10:30 show before the actual show. You know, it won't be as special if we kind of lumped it all together and made it one long 90-minute kind of goulash. So instead, we're trying to make the 10:30 half-hour its own sort of special free-form talk musical thingy. And then the 11 o'clock is kind of the big Monongahela long-standing, really amazing thingy. So they're both thingies, essentially, but they're different kinds of thingies. And I'm proud to be hosting both of them, except the 10:30 thingy is co-hosted, generally, by my good friend Jeff Goodman, who will be here shortly. He was actually going to call in. He's on the Wantagh Parkway. He's on his way to the studio, taking him a little longer than he thought it would, and he was also going to call in, and I was going to talk him through coming to the radio station and you know, being here. Oh, that seems to be him on the phone, so I'm just going to put him through. Hopefully this will work. Just gonna pop him up. Jeff Goodman, are you on the telephone? Hello?
I didn't hear you at all. What did it say?
Jeff, okay. Are you there? Hello?
Are we on the air?
Yes. We're on the actually, I should have told you that. Kind of as a legal thing. Yes, you are on the air now. Because you called in 5 minutes later. What?
You think I'd know that because I'm driving in my car, yet not tuned in to the correct station.
Oh, well, that's a problem. You haven't even been listening to my magnificent introduction. Thank you so much. But how are you doing, Jeff?
I am doing great.
Good. Good.
I am driving on my way to WGBB, which is all very exciting.
Okay, and now, let's also, first of all, before anything else, assure that our listeners that today you picked up an item for your cell phone so that you are not holding the cell phone in your hand while you are driving, which would be illegal in New York State, as it should be. You have, like, this thing where the cell phone's on the dash, and you don't even have to touch it, right?
It's fantastic.
Well, good.
I love it.
So what is it? It's sticky on the back, and you can just... What is it?
It's just like, yeah, it's like tacky.
Okay.
So one side stays on your dashboard.
Uh-huh.
It's a little pad. It's like a little mouse pad thing.
Well, cool.
And it's like tacky. And you can get our favorite little office snacks in Levittown.
Uh-huh.
I can't remember, what is it, JP and...
Oh, Tariq or Tarif was...
Tariq.
Some very nice people who helped and tolerated as we wandered through Office Max for like 2 hours, just bargaining over things.
2 hours, and you got a great deal on a chair.
Yes, I got a wonderful deal on a chair that looks more beat up than some of the chairs we have in the studio here. But that's why I got a good deal on it. So anyway, Jeff, how far away are you at the moment?
I am on Route 109, and I'm just getting up to the intersection of 109 and... Wellwood Avenue.
Oh, so you're almost here. That's good, because this your cell phone's terrible. The Birds, ladies and gentlemen, 5D, Fifth Dimension. Always really liked that song. Actually, I didn't know about it until fairly recently when I grabbed the Birds' Greatest Hits package. And I'd never heard that one because we all know 8 Miles High and we all know Turn, Turn, Turn and some of the other songs that they did. But that's just one of those that I just heard and I was like, wow, that is so pretty. And speaking of pretty, one of the prettiest men I know, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome, not on a cell phone, thank goodness, but in the studio, the one, the only, Jeff Goodman. Jeff Goodman, hello. Whoops. What did you say?
I feel pretty.
Do you feel pretty, witty, and, or just pretty and witty?
Oh, so pretty. I feel pretty, witty.
Such a pretty you. Such a pretty you.
Such a pretty me. Such a pretty me.
You're pretty, sure. You're much better dressed than you usually are. You're usually kind of slovenly. No offense. It's a Sunday. Why not?
What does that mean?
You're ashamed.
You look like a pig.
No offense, but you'll usually look like a pig.
Well, I've got, like, you know, crusting my neck and everything, but, you look good.
What the hell is wrong with all these cell phones? These earphones?
Oh, the earphones at the stage? Oh, it's hilarious. You know, it's recommended that people bring their own headphones to the radio station.
Recommended? These are in pieces.
That's why it's recommended.
We're going to have a WGBB headphone and spit cover of the microphones drive.
Yeah.
We're trying to raise $13 so we can buy these things.
Well, you know what would happen? The reason they don't even bother is that people take them. People break them, they take them, they take the little pieces, they walk away with them, and a month later they buy...
Who would take these things?
People take. And people treat stuff that isn't theirs like garbage.
Next time I go on the airplane, I'm going to steal a couple of headphones for you.
Well, cool. And bring them here. That'd be great, you know?
And bring them here. Mm-hmm. Like they deserve.
Payback. Except now you've told anybody listening from United or from American that you're going to do this.
That's okay. I'm a frequent flyer.
Just don't bring any liquids. You can take as many headphones.
No, you can take liquids now.
Oh, right. Okay.
You can take the little 5-ounce containers and a Ziploc baggie.
No, 5-ounce. How do you... Have you ever tried to quench a thirst with a 5-ounce container of anything?
No, but you get the refreshments on board. I'm just happy about the toothpaste. Toothpaste, mouthwash, things that you need on board a plane. You really do.
Trust me, other people need them.
Anal ointment, which is, you know, definitely a... Only Farrah Fawcett needs that now.
I don't know about you, but I don't need too much lubrication on a plane.
Hey, how about Farrah? There were three topics in the half hour that I wanted to talk about. And, of course, in this half hour of it, we have only 10 minutes left now.
Well, let's talk about Farrah Fawcett, and then I'll tell you what I've confirmed.
Okay. What have you confirmed?
Farrah Fawcett has a pain in her ass.
As opposed to being one.
No, she just had big hair. She was on every boy's post ball as a teenager.
Oh, this is the absolute honest to God truth. She was not on my
phone call.
How
does that work?
Somebody might be actually listening. Then entertain our listeners while I'm taking a phone. Oh, they're gone. They're gone. They're.
You scared them.
That was
away.
Farrah. Farrah was calling us.
Farrah, I was trying to. Wasn't? But she was. What was the? She was great in The Burning Bed, and she was great in
Extremities.
Extremities. That was.
I don't know if she was. I didn't see them, but she apparently was really, really good.
No, she was.
But the weird thing is, we used to have a poster of that famous poster of Farrah Fawcett from Charlie's Angels era in our basement, and it wasn't mine. It was my dad's. Well, you know, it was a good, let's see, it's a good 20 years or so older than I am. So he had the Farrah poster. I didn't mind it, but she wasn't my favorite.
Dad's
you know.
An old horn dog.
Totally. But, well, so am I. But I think I was more a Jacqueline Smith man.
I think you just try hard.
Yeah. Well, you should see how hard I tried with that poster. No, I'm just kidding. I kid.
I don't even know what that means.
Thank you. No, I was not into Charlie's Angels. I mean, I know they were the hot thing to watch, but no, Jacqueline Smith was the prettiest, but I wasn't into them, onto them. You know, I didn't watch it with a box of Kleenex by the TV.
No. You were more of a Get Smart kind of guy.
Oh, God, Barbara Feldon. I was pre-sexual when I was watching her, but when I was watching her, I knew I was sexual. I don't know what that... I do know what that means.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, she was like...
What did Agent 99 always say? Agent 86 always say?
Sorry about that, Chief.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Well, yeah, a bunch of other things.
Yeah.
Missed it by that much.
That's right.
That's the other one,
and
yeah.
I Need the Robot.
Oh. Only Mel Brooks. It never occurred to me. You know, Jaime was such a Jewish kind of a name for... Yeah, and it was not an offensive one at that point.
And was that Bernie Coppell? Who was Bernie Coppell?
No, Jaime was Dick Gaudier.
Oh, that's right.
Bernie Coppell was Siegfried.
Oh, Siegfried. That's right.
It was wonderful. I mean, the fact that they wasted him in crap like The Love Boat, well, he was the great Siegfried.
He made a lot of money.
One
he made more money.
Television roles of all time.
Love Boat.
Schmott. And who are some of the other... Miraculous.
But wait, no, but I have big news, because I did confirm something at dinner.
What? Which was lovely, thank you, Mr. and Mrs. Schwartz.
You had a baby confirmed. No, what?
No, I confirmed the fact that the woman whose apartment was hit by the plane is the woman who got hit by the Macy's Thanksgiving Day balloon.
No, okay, roll this back. Everybody knows that this week an apartment building in New York on the Upper East Side was crashed into, not by an Arab, not by a lunatic terrorist, well, maybe a lunatic terrorist, but he's also a ball player named Corey Lytle.
A Yankee.
A Yankee. Not a Met, ladies and gentlemen. I mean, it's like, we all knew that watching the playoffs that Ligel couldn't aim, but this was...
God.
Oh, come on. Yeah, he has a new pitch now. High heat. I was going to save these for later, but I'm going to use them
that
now.
That was a low ball.
Nicely put, yeah. Well, he is a Bronx bomber, if you think about it. Ba-dum-bum.
He was down and out.
So anyway, he went to pieces. Now, will you stop worrying about the headphones and whatever you're doing and potchkeying with? Just talk to me.
It's like a vibrator or something.
You wish. What is that?
No idea. It's an egg with a cord attached.
Oh, maybe. It's that vibrating egg from Annie Hall.
So anyway, speaking of Annie.
Was that her name?
No.
Oh.
Well, we have to know about Miss Hannigan.
Oh, it's going to be Kathy Lee Gifford. Well, they went for evil. They went for typecasting evil.
I mean, she went from, now she's going to actually abuse kids on stage rather than abuse kids in foreign lands to make her clothing. But wait, no, but the woman who did get rained on by the Yankees, or, you know, whatever that was.
Well, yeah. It's raining.
It turns out that she was the same woman who got boinked on the head by a lamppost.
You know what it reminds me of now? In that I never saw them, but the movie series called Final Destination, where the whole film is basically all these people who are supposed to die in a terrible accident, and some do, but some live by some weird miracle, except they're supposed to die.
Well, they don't. Because there has to be another sequel.
Right, yeah. So throughout the whole movie, it's just basically them in different situations where they ultimately do die in weird and horrible and sometimes really bizarrely funny ways. So here's this woman. Twice this woman has cheated.
Something tells me it's about time she has to move out of New York. Something
that's
is
right.
Little. She's not getting the clues. They're not quite big enough. First time she gets bonked on the head by a light post.
Right.
Which she goes, oh, look at all the money the city gave me. Let's buy this lovely apartment. And then a plane flies into her apartment.
Yeah.
Ma'am, I think it's time to move.
Yeah, I wonder if she's going to...
We all love New York, but New York doesn't particularly love you.
Has she lined up a new job at One World Trade Center when they build it?
Oh, my God.
Because, you know, like 5 days after they put the finishing touches on the next skyscraper there.
Well, you know what she's going to be on the new watch list at the airports, because would you fly with her on the plane?
No, crap, no.
No.
Everybody dies near her.
Well, it's like that Bruce Willis film that he was the only survivor.
Oh, yeah, The Sixth Sense, of course.
No, The Sixth Sense. It was the one.
Oh, what movie was that? Huh. Oh, well. Oh, it was 12 Monkeys.
I don't know. It's another M. Night Shyamalan.
Another show. So I did want to mention, though, about the whole Corey Ligel thing. That it was kind of funny the way the media and people treat things. Had it not been Corey Ligel, it would have just been some schmuck who gets in an airplane with 70 hours of training. And the fact that it was someone as rich as Corey Ligel with as many options as he could, what would it have killed him to go take a regular plane flight to somewhere like Kansas or the middle of the country
where it can fly over cornfields. He was going home to California.
Yeah.
And he decided to take one more look at the city. And,
well, he should have turned. If you're going to California, turn west. You'll turn east into the 18th floor of someone's house.
No, he just.
But what I'm saying is, had it just been some. There was, oh, this idiot and people shouldn't be flying this. But as soon as they heard it was Corey Ligel, ooh, a Yankee. It was, oh, it's so sad. Oh, he was a good ball player. Oh, he made everybody told jokes all the time. People liked him.
Well, you know what was kind of funny?
What was kind of funny about that was that they said that, and then all of a sudden, I guess they must have been getting calls about the other guy. They said, oh, why are you making such a big deal of Corey Ligel? Two people died in that. And then all the news organizations had to go find out who his pilot was. They flew crews out to California.
Well, you mentioned that's important because apparently the widow, it makes a difference. Who?
Oh, yes. Well, you know that if it finds out that Corey Ligel was not flying the plane, his wife will get $1 million from a life insurance policy. And if he was flying the plane,
that she won't have millions and millions of dollars from...
I don't think the pension is that big.
From the Yankees?
It's from the baseball. Remember, it's not just on his contract. He's covered by Major League Baseball insurance or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I don't know if it's that, you know.
So the Yankees
usually
don't
when you retire
like
from baseball, you have another career afterwards.
True. But, I mean, so, these days, so people in baseball make $12 million a year. Or, well, maybe he wasn't.
Some people do, but a lot of people just make minimum, which is not a, not even half a million a year. How could they live?
How can people work for less than half a million? I just don't know.
I don't know how they do it. I couldn't live like that.
Anyway.
Don't know where I'd be without this gigantic WGBB salary. Now, that's the joke of the evening.
Indeed. Anyway, but I'm just, it bothers me.
I'm still trying to peel tape from headphones. Yeah,
will you concentrate on this instead of doing that?
I am trying to salvage at least, I'm trying to salvage my ears from these horrible, horrible headphones.
Oh, I know.
That's the new movie, Horrible, Horrible Headphones.
Well, actually, Dev's Gone By is going to be on in just a couple of minutes, ladies and gentlemen. And
We don't have to promo it. It's on in 2 minutes.
Well, let me tell people why they should stay tuned, because a lot of people might want to watch
absolutely
the
no
net game.
Why they should stay tuned. They want to listen to us. I want to talk about Miss Hannigan.
Well, you have 1.5 minutes, so talk.
Okay.
It's going to be Kathy Lee Gifford.
I think that's hilarious.
The new
How art imitates life.
Well, yeah, okay, we did that bit, but what else are you looking forward to the show otherwise?
No.
I thought you would like Annie. It seems like a show you would really enjoy.
Little girl.
I didn't mean it that way. Perhaps you did, John Mark Carr.
John Mark Carr as Rooster. Wouldn't that be hilarious?
Yeah, okay.
And John
They just changed his name to Cock, though.
No, John Mark Carr as as Daddy Warbucks.
Come with, live with me, little girl.
Everyone in the audience goes, creep factor.
Yeah.
That was another thing I was listening
My dong will come out tomorrow. Come and sit down on Big Daddy Warbucks. Okay, anyway.
Because I love you, Jean-Denis.
You're right. Okay, we got like half another minute. What were you going to say?
God bless us all, everyone.
Okay, that's a totally different show. That's a Christmas.
But that's actually the show that took over. Now, how about The Grinch? I'm looking forward to The Grinch.
Now, are you looking forward to, I mean, yeah. It was a big hit in California.
Hit's a weird one.
Mr. Grinch. All right, speaking of.
Oh, I finally got my headphones together.
Congratulations. Just when we're not going to need them, because I've got to go into commercial now, a couple of ID things, or IUD things, if you're women.
And stay tuned, because it's a really uninteresting edition of Days Gone By. It's so incredibly boring, you'll want to be there.
Yeah, exactly. It's like a car wreck. You kind of have to see it and hear it for yourself.
Trust me, you won't believe what you're hearing.
Greetings from Long Island, where every highway is a sunrise. It's time for Dave's Gone By, an hour of comedy, talk, and music brought to you by Total Theater, with your host, Dave Lefkowitz. You've never heard anything like it, so sit back, relax, squeal if you must. Here's the host of Dave's Gone By, Dave!
Tropical hot dog night! I shoot flamingos in a fruit fight! Every color of day, whirling around at night.
There goes the neighborhood. Welcome, everybody, to Dave's Gone By on this October 15th, 2006. So glad to have you here with us for this episode called The First of All My Dreams, which... not a title I thought of, but it is related to the folks that I'm going to have on this episode of the show. It's going to be really, really neat. But before I tell you exactly what it's about, let me get my good guest co-host on the program with me, Jeff Goodman, to say hi.
Hello.
Thank you so much.
No,
that's more like your cell phone. That's pretty good. You do that pretty well.
Thank you.
Now you sound like the school for the deaf.
Let me tell you, it's not funny to make fun of deaf people.
Yes, it
is. Did you see My Name is Earl?
This week, no.
Maybe it was last week where she had Marley Matlin as an attorney,
uh-huh.
Joy, and she goes, I don't like deaf people. I don't like people who can't hear it was hilarious. And she just makes fun of deaf people, and then the guy goes, you know, she can read lips too.
Oh, no, actually the best line Marley Matlin had She said, ay, 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 ay. Sorry, that's awful.
Oh, no, actually, at the end, Joy comes back to apologize. She goes, I'm really sorry. And she goes, I got you this card, but I couldn't find a card for deaf people. So I got you one for the blind people with all the little dots on it. And she goes, I hope you, I'm really sorry. And she wants to take the case back. And Molly Matt and goes, that's okay. I'll take you back. And to which Joy answers, it just makes that laugh.
Oh, God.
It was hilarious. It was really hilarious.
Oh, that's a good show.
That's another one of my favorites. I think My Name Is Earl is
the talk show. Into the... When you go
I
away from the microphone...
Very, very clever. I'm sorry.
Anyway,
I just don't like the idea of my mouth touching this thing.
So not the only thing you
don't
like...
that often.
You beat me to it. Thank you. Hey, before we do anything else, let's beat ourselves to... announcing who our sponsors are for this program, as they are every week.
Wait, hold on. Let me divine this.
Okay.
Who is
MortgagesRock.com? Yes.
Because they really rock.
Right.
That's really. You just log on
to their website,
and you can make money off your mortgage, someone else's mortgage. Make up a mortgage if you want.
Yeah, pretty much.
Really, okay.
And then, who else? Who are our other sponsors?
Oh, the people at Hewlett Minuteman Press.
Wonderful family. They've been run, it's a family-owned business for about 20, 25 years.
Serving all our copying needs, except for the ones we had today, because we were not...
Well, because we weren't in that neighborhood. But if you are...
But we're going back to...
South Shore of in Hewlett, Long Island, Hewlett Minuteman Press.
Where are they located?
1516 Broadway, right next to the Lohman's Shoe Store, the new Lohman's Shoe Store in Hewlett.
It's a new Lohman's Shoe Store.
Oh, yeah. Down. Oh, yeah.
Oh, my.
And Performing Arts Insider Theater Magazine.
Never heard of it.
Yeah.
It's a crappy little thing I like to refer to as my theater Bible.
Yes, it is. Everything on and off Broadway, everything you need to know.
Everything you need to know, want to know, or didn't even care to know is in there.
It's in there, and it's worth every penny. And speaking of being worth every penny, aside from your friendship and your being here, you do some pretty good work yourself that people might be interested in.
Oh, I forgot about Fancy Schmancy Balloons.
Fancy
for
Schmancy
all your
balloons.
Party needs.
Which is basically balloons and centipedes. You don't do the flowers, but balloons and centipedes.
Anything that is decorated that we put in the room that you cannot eat or sniff.
Well, unless
I
you're
guess.
Really...
I don't know.
Crazy.
Well, you could eat
you can like
styrofoam.
Styrofoam. Yeah. And how can people...
They can reach me by calling area code 516-797-32.
Wow. Wow. This is my lap knocking up against the desk right here. Not really. Okay. Now, to the content of this episode of Dave's Gone By, our 192nd show. It's really going to be great. We've got two musicians
is
on the program.
Is this really 192?
Really is. Ellen Mandel and Michael Lydon. Now, not only are they married and have been married for a couple of decades now.
They're having sex?
And I believe they still are.
That's amazing.
I wouldn't necessarily want to watch them. No, they're good looking. They're good looking. Sorry about that guy. But what's kind of neat is...
Is she related to Howie Mandel?
You know, I didn't ask, but I don't think so.
Could you touch her hands? Or do you have to knock this?
Oh, because he's got that germ phobia. Okay. Let me introduce this, or I'm going to have to cut the mic.
Okay.
Okay. But
it's just so hard to stay silent.
Just for a moment or two, because we've got to get to this, and I want to get enough time, because the stories, especially that Michael's going to tell, because, I mean, Ellen's got some good stuff, because she has been composing music for plays off and off Broadway for years, more than 50 of them, and you know, we'll be playing some of their music, obviously. Michael, aside from being a singer and songwriter, was a founding editor of Rolling Stone magazine.
Wow.
He followed the Rolling Stones across country on the and a wonderful Altamont tour. We all remember that one.
What was that one?
That was the one that climaxed at Altamont Speedway in, I think it was Indianapolis, with the Hells Angels guarding it. Oh, come on. It was Gimme Shelter, dude. All right. Well, you'll hear about it.
Dude. Did
and
you just call me
I did call you dude. Well, yeah.
I'm not your
well, you're
dude.
Not a dude that looks like a lady. You're just a dude. Although you are clean shaven today. You look very nice. What else did he do? Oh, and he wrote a book about Ray Charles. Very noted book. And he... You know, interview Ray Charles
What's
a lot.
It, called?
It was a semi-authorized biography.
What's
here.
It called?
Something like Ray Charles, the man, the myth, the blind. See, I worked the blind thing in there again. There we go.
Don't make them as blind people.
They all blind people talk.
Before they hit the wall.
Yeah, well, once they hit the wall. Hello, my name is Ray Charles, and I'm blind. And
Well,
I got a woman way across town. Be good to me. Oh, yeah.
You're just lucky he's dead.
Well, in a manner of speaking. So, anyway, Jeff, thanks for being with us on this episode of Dave's Gone By. Everybody.
This is my bye-bye time?
Well, for a while. But you're going to come back because I, you know, I didn't want to put you with Ellen because they're hippies.
You don't want me to talk to them?
And I eat you. It's kind of a thing. They're so hungry from their commune. No, I don't know what that means.
Well.
Anyway, stick around, everybody. Got a couple of commercials to do, and we will be right back with Ellen Mandel and Michael Lydon on Dave's Gone By. It's going to be great.
We'll knock this.
Back after this. Welcome back to Dave's Gone By, and I'm sure we've heard of people who work together. They're married, they're living together, but they also share the same job, which is kind of weird and interesting sometimes, because a lot of people go to work to get away from their spouses, and then, you know, they come home and they've had all these experiences and things to do, and they come home and share that, and that way a marriage can go for years and years and years. But some people do what they do together. It becomes this lifelong thing, and when it's an artistic endeavor, I find that really interesting too. So my guests on tonight's program are folks who have done that musically and sometimes lyrically. I'm going to be talking to Michael Lydon and Ellen Mandel. They've been married for, actually, I'm not sure how long, I'll ask them, but quite a few years now, and they've also been working together on musical projects and CDs and music for the theater for a while, and they've had quite interesting lives as well. So welcome to the neighborhood, Ellen and Michael. How are you guys doing?
Very good. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
So how long have you guys been a twosome?
Well, we're coming up on our 25th anniversary.
Mit Mazel, mit Glück.
Thank you. Very exciting.
Do you have kids?
Yes, we have a grown-up daughter. Lives in California.
With grandkids yet, or?
Not yet. Maybe one day.
Are you pushing, or are you saying,
we would never nag.
Time's a-wasting, you know. So, okay. So, you then, let me start with Michael, because sure. I guess you were doing the music stuff a bit before then. I mean, you came of age kind of in the 60s.
I loved rock and roll music and pop music, and in the 60s I started writing about it. I was a founding editor of Rolling Stone, and I traveled on the road with the Rolling Stones and B.B. King.
Okay,
Grateful Dead, the whole bit.
No, well, stop right there. I mean, that's going to be the next 5 minutes of this conversation. Sorry, but
that's okay. And I wasn't even there. It's so pathetic.
You weren't born until 1980.
I was born, yeah. And it's strange.
But so, all right, you were a founding editor
of
Rolling Stone.
Right.
So what's Jan Wenner really like? Or what was he like back when?
He was a good guy. He was extremely ambitious. He was driven by ambition. But he knew what he was doing. I helped, no question. I was there as part of the original team. But Rolling Stone was Jan Wenner's baby from day one. He had the name, he had the whole idea, and he's followed it through. I was really involved with the paper for the first 7 or 8 issues, and then I wrote for them for a few years after that. But it's been a long time. But we had a wonderful fun. It was like, but I tell people now, it was like trying to start a website or trying to start a theater group. It was really a few kids, a few bucks, and upstairs in the attic of a printer who gave us the space free because he wanted to print the paper.
Wow. And do you remember did you have like a list of the ethos, the rules, or the dreams of it, or, I mean, that you set?
Well, it was really out of the whole hippie thing, and it was really a response to the music. You know, Jan and myself and the whole gang, we loved the Beatles. We thought they were important artists. We thought that Dylan was really saying something. We thought the Stones were saying something. So we wanted to respond. It was part of our and everybody's desire to be the fifth Beatle, to join the conversation, to get in there with them.
There's like 8 fifth Beatles, aren't there? There's Klaus Voormann. there was Neil Innes for a moment. It was like...
There were many. Well, it was a whole... It was a way you thought that, as I remember it, the Beatles and the Dylan and the Stones were such exciting artists. And they were exactly our age. So you just felt you couldn't stand on the sidelines. You wanted to jump in, too. And they were encouraging you to jump in. You know, he not busy being born is busy dying. Well, like, I don't want to be busy dying. I want to be busy born. So how could you get in there? How could you make your own contribution that... It was a challenge. I heard all those guys as a challenge to me personally to do my very best.
Well, going to stay a little while about writing for Rolling Stone. Do you remember your first piece that you wrote for them, Michael Lydon?
Yes, it was a piece called Where's the Money from Monterey? Just a few months before, there had been the Monterey Pop Concert,
right,
which had supposedly been for charity, and the money was going to go to do something. Well, in fact, the people who had done it, they hadn't stolen the money, but they had just, they didn't know what to do with it, so it was just sitting in the bank. Actually, then the secretary who worked for them at the time, she ran off with the money.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But I think some of it did end up with some music schools, and it was fun. But Jan wanted some investigative reporting in the very first issue, so that was
wow.
My goal.
So, still continuing with after you stopped with the founding process, you still wrote for them, and you followed. You said you followed the Beatles and Stones, not just
The Beatles, but I went on the whole 1969 Rolling Stones tour that ended at Altamont.
So you were at Altamont.
Yeah. It was
what didn't we see in the film Gimme Shelter, or was that exactly the same?
Gimme Shelter, you saw it. You saw it. It was a strange, weird, ugly day, and it was really. It was sort of the reverse of Woodstock. Everyone hoped it would be a Woodstock, but deeper currents of destruction and real evil came out that day, no question.
You felt it while you were
there.
Oh,
absolutely. Absolutely. You could feel it happen.
I mean, did you see any horrible... I mean, you obviously weren't up close to where the knife was going in.
Well, I was on stage, and I saw at one point this big, hulking Hell's Angel raising a pool cue above his head and just smashing it down. I couldn't see who it hit, but somehow there was this big spray of water, and you just felt it was as if he had crushed a jellyfish. It was awful. It was an ugly, ugly day.
And was that day indicative of the way the tour was going at that point, or it just come out of nowhere? So that day, everything bad happened and the 60s were over.
Well, no, but I think, I mean, I was a complete convinced hippie. I was into it. Love, peace, this is, you know, music, this was it. But clearly in the human spirit, there are deeper and darker counter currents to all that. So this was the day when a lot of the naivete of being hippie, just peace and flowers are going to stop human ugliness, that got stripped away very, very sharply from myself and from a lot of other people.
Wow.
It was strange. And then after that, I felt I'm going to go into a more private kind of being a hippie, not just sort of we're going to go to big, huge events that are going to be a testament to everything, more just tend to my own garden and tend to my own music and tend to my own work in a quieter way.
So even into the 70s, when people stopped being hippies, you kind of...
Ellen and I met sometime around then, and then I started to play music, and so then I wasn't just a reporter anymore, I was in it myself.
So how did you guys meet? Ellen, you want to take that?
Well, we had a mutual friends who were friends with each other. So we met through them.
Were they also musicians in that circle?
No, they were, one of them was a graduate student, a radical, an organizer, like a labor organizer, radical type of guy.
Tell them, Ellen, we met at a commune.
Really?
Terrifying. Yeah. Terrifying.
What was a commune? I've never been to a kibbutz, and...
This was just, Well, I was not part of it, but it was roommates living in a house.
Oh, it's like the real world.
But around a common purpose of political idealism and rock and roll and a little pot smoked in the corners and stuff like that. It was nice. It was nice.
Do you guys still indulge? Do you imbibe or no?
No, a long time ago.
And you're not winking, so...
We're not winking and we're awake.
But you avoided, I mean, as hippies, did you avoid the heavy drugs? Because a lot of people didn't.
Yes, we did. I mean, and we were very fortunate that the hippies we knew and were drawn to, and I guess ourselves, were sort of, we liked brown rice, we liked vegetables, we liked peaceful, it was a feeling of peacefulness and friendship, really, and music, and I think a lot of people...
Mm-hmm.
Just, you know, would be led astray. They would meet people and they'd seem like fun, but then there was really coke or
you have to work. You have to tend the garden.
The people we met and the people we liked were very down to earth, nice folks.
Well, do you consider? I don't know if you ever, I guess, consider yourself a hippie, but do you consider yourself still hippies or countercultural or basically times change people and you settle into things?
Well, I call myself a musician.
Okay.
And others do, too, so...
And also, it's funny that you call yourself a musician, but in your bio, Ellen Mandel...
Yes.
It says you have written 50 plays, 5-0?
No, yeah. Not plays, plays, music for plays.
Scored.
Right. Yeah.
Gotta check that website
out. Yeah. Read carefully. I haven't written any plays.
So let's go back to the beginning of that then. Do you remember the first play that you scored?
I do. I started in theater by doing live piano playing for improvisational comedy.
Wow.
And it was really, really fun. I was with a terrific company through whose doors passed Bruce Willis and John Leguizamo. Bruce Willis, I didn't work with. John Leguizamo, I did. He was incredibly talented, talent. And a lot of other people who are very talented who have not become as famous as I think that they should have.
But would we have heard of them in a smaller way?
Probably not. A fellow named Joe Purse, who actually plays a part on Michael's most recent CD that you'll probably play later.
Yeah, we'll get. We will.
But He told us that he put his son through college on a tiny bit that he did for the Olive Garden.
Oh,
commercial
will do it.
Yeah, but as a result of creating music live for these comedy shows and just writing it on the spot, I said to myself, gee, you know, I'll bet I can actually write music for theater, and that's how I started out.
Well, the one other thing that I found in the bio is that both of you at one point opened for Muddy Waters?
Yes,
that was working as a duo.
Up in Boston.
Very exciting. Yeah, at the Paradise in Boston.
Were you doing blues, or was it a folky sort of a thing, or what?
It's kind of like the music that we play when we play together now, kind of jazzy, pop, swing, some originals, some standards.
Well, I want to play a cut of yours, but let me just ask, did you meet Muddy? I mean, what was he like? What was the...
Oh, yeah.
Michael, yeah?
We went into his dressing room to pay our respects and tell him how much we loved his music, and he was the sweetest gentleman. He said, oh, and you guys sound great, too. So, which was very,
that's
very
nice.
Gracious of him, and we loved him, and we learned so much from watching, and he could lead his band with the slightest lift of an eyebrow, and the whole band would just do exactly what he wanted them to do. So he, a master musician and a fine gentleman, and we loved him.
Oh, all right. I am going to play a cut of yours, but I want to hear about other musicians, too, I mean, that you've worked with or opened for or any other anecdotes.
Well, I had the luck through this comedy show. I somehow ended up being on a national TV show with Bill Boggs. He had some kind of a comedy show.
Yeah.
And he wanted to sing, so I was going to play with him. And he said, oh, well, you know, Dizzy Gillespie's going to be a guest on the show. He'll sit in with us. And so I thought, that's ridiculous. That's never going to happen. But sure enough, he did. So I got to play with Dizzy Gillespie that day, and it was just fabulous.
What
fabulous.
Separates someone like Dizzy Gillespie from another sort of horn cornet player? What's fabulous about someone like that?
Well, to me, on that day, he played such beautiful music, and while we were waiting to go on, and first we rehearsed the tune, and I was telling him what the arrangement was. I felt, this is just crazy. He should be telling me, not I telling him, but just, you know, this little singing arrangement. And then when we were waiting to actually do the performance, standing backstage behind behind the set, he was noodling very, very quietly, very, very quietly on his trumpet. Mm. The most celestial, exquisite, gorgeous stuff you have ever heard. It was just wonderful. I mean, just unbelievable. And then the guy was, again, so nice. After he gave me a ride home, I couldn't believe it. He was just a doll, you know. But the noodlings that I heard were like the best music you're ever going to hear in your life.
He didn't do any noodlings with you on the ride home, did he? You know, just wondering.
No, just a sweetie pie.
And Michael, you look like you were about to jump in with another remembrance of another.
Well, I was going to say that Dizzy said that we went to see him a few nights later at the club in New York, and we went backstage, and he said to me, now, you got a wonderful musician there, meaning Ellen. said, yes, indeed, I know it.
Well, let's hear some wonderful music. Let's why don't you set us up with a song that you guys have worked together on, either for a theater project, or sometimes you set poetry to music. I know that's something very important to you.
Well, the poetry that I've set to music, which I'd love you to play a little of, is I've been writing it in the vein of classical song settings. I write out all the notes for the piano player. This is basically so that anybody can play it who can read music. So those are just vocal, a very fine singer named Todd Almond, and myself on piano playing these parts. Michael is not on those, but he's played on a number of my theater pieces, which we can hear on the song from Rough Crossing that maybe you'll play.
What's the name of it?
It's called This Could Be the One. It starts off with a silly little piano segue, which I think everybody will know everything in, and then we hit into the tune, and you'll hear Michael playing, too.
All right, so On Dave's Gone By, Ellen Mandel and Michael Lydon playing, or from the CD.
This Could Be the One, lyrics by Tom Stoppard.
Could be the one. And actually, I have the two here in the neighborhood on Dave's Gone By. That was a song from the CD Every Plays an Opera, Theater Music by Ellen Mandel. And Ellen is here with us in the neighborhood alongside her co-music partner and husband of 25 years, Michael Lydon. And again, so you've done, Ellen, a bunch now of like 50 song or music cycles for plays.
Yes, sometimes they're songs, sometimes they're just instrumental music, whatever's appropriate to the play. Sometimes it's Greek tragedies with kind of synthesizer, strange mood stuff. Some of it is violin and accordion. It's just whatever is needed.
Was there any show that was particularly exciting or challenging or where you really felt, wow, this is big, or I'm really up against it?
Well, sometimes the Rough Crossing that we just heard was an incredible amount of fun. It's a very, very funny show, and one of the pieces that we did live was just percussion. The scene was set on an ocean liner, and these characters who are the composer and the songwriter of the show try to show the song to the actress they want to play it, and they don't have any instruments, so they just use the items they have on their breakfast table, the tray covers and the pepper shaker and all that kind of thing. And we laughed our heads off rehearsing it. It was so funny.
Sounds like sort of
wonderful,
a stomp kind of
yes,
thing.
Exactly. It was so much fun. It was just great.
Now, one other thing about sort of homemade-ish kind of music is that, I don't know if both of you, but it's like on your website, Michael, which is what, michaellydon.com?
michaellydon.com, yeah.
M-I-C-H-E-L.
A-E-L.
A-E-L, and then
Lydon. Right.
Cool, michaellydon.com. And Ellen, you've got your own site, which is Ellen Mandel. One L in Mandel?
One L, like Howie Mandel.
Mandel. .com. But you don't have to wash your hands 10 times before going to her website.
No.
But you apparently busked, as it were.
Yeah, I did. I played in a band, and then solo in the New York subway system for 6 or 7 years. It was rough. It wasn't so easy. But I worked it out so that I basically played at Astor Place Station, which is near our house.
Yeah.
And in the subway program, you were assigned a spot and a time. So it became sort of a stroll from my house to Astor Place, set up, play for a couple of hours, and go home. And I liked it, and I made friends and fans there, and I hand out cards and get gigs, and people came to know me a little bit, because living in the neighborhood, a lot of our pals came through, and people I met there then would later come to clubs. I had a lot of fun. I also felt that I really honed my own personal style there, because even though I was playing in the subway, I used to think to myself, this is television, because this is anybody and everybody. This isn't playing to a cabaret audience or a college audience or to a... This is anybody at all might come through, just like when you're on television or when you're on radio now. Anybody might be listening. So in those years playing in the subway, I sort of, I called it developed my persona, developed who I was to the public. And it was a very educational experience. I loved it.
Well, what were some of the things that you got or learned how to do or to cope with when you're on a subway platform and trying to get people to stick around and maybe throw a dollar in?
Well, I just, I sort of found my own wavelength. I don't know, it's a little hard to describe. But if you think of Willie Nelson, or you think of Cary Grant.
Oh, we're going back to marijuana again. All right, yeah.
No, but, or B.B. King. As natural as those folks are, they've really worked out some connection between their own private personal selves and their public self.
Mm-hmm.
And so, me with a little bit of hippie, a little bit of gray in my hair, a little bit of Ivy League, a little bit of all the elements of my personality, I somehow tried to coalesce them in what I like to play. And then the songs that went over, or the ways in which I connected that I could tell worked, I kept those. Things that didn't work so well, I let fade off to the sides. And the toughest thing was some other musicians who would try to poach in your spot. And I had some absolutely nose-to-nose, toe-to-toe battles to keep my spot. And that's really eventually what made it not worth it. I would get so riled up. You had to win. In that situation, when you're playing in the subway, if you lost, you became low man on the totem pole, and you couldn't. I had to fight for my spot, and it was very difficult and very unpleasant.
Now, you don't need a license or permission from the subway.
You don't, MTA, but I did. The MTA does have a program,
right? Yeah,
which sort of books you, and that was good. Being a totally freelance busker just out there, that was sort of a gypsy existence. That was.
Never did that together, did you? Or?
No, I never went out because I'm a piano player, and to carry
that would be a little
carry
tough.
All that stuff. Yeah. And I've done a fair amount of playing in various restaurants and clubs and all that kind of thing, which is kind of the same, but you know, always someplace there was a place.
I'm going to go back to some other thing that I forgot to mention before, but again in the bio for Michael Lydon, is that, and I sort of skirted over it when we were talking about the Beatles and Dylan and the Stones, but you followed the Stones, but you apparently interviewed at one point, a fairly early point, Paul McCartney and John Lennon.
Yeah, I did, in London, in 1966.
You were there? Yeah, I wanted to get into that whole thing, because you were living there, you were covering things from London. So, again, what was the swinging 60s in London like, and then actually interviewing John and Paul when they were in the Beatles?
Well, the swinging 60s in London were great, and it's hard for Americans to realize, but it took England a lot longer to recover from the Second World War than America, because London had been, the cities had been bombed, and they were on the front lines rather than with the ocean away from the battles. So it was only in the mid 60s that London and England were really totally recovering and recovered. So there was this spirit of youthful optimism. The Beatles were fabulous, and they were influencing everybody. They gave everybody a new sense of hope. So it was a real youth movement of all kinds, and connected with the whole youth movement going on. And John and Paul were great. They were very much the way I think people, their personas did come through the media. John was sort of a little abrasive and cynical and quick-tongued and not about to please you unless he wanted to. Whereas Paul was extremely charming and knew how to pour oil on the waves and was a publicity man's dream. But they were both very nice and very intelligent and capable, and I felt flattered that they talked to me and treated me. Again, I got this feeling from them of, you're a guy, Michael. Anything we're doing, you could do. So I got this challenge from them to be myself.
Isn't your interview in that book, Flashbacks,
that you wrote? That's right.
I can't resist.
Yes.
Flashbacks by Michael Leiden.
And that's out there. You'll find that on Amazon or, you know, by...
Who was the publisher on that?
Rutledge. R-O-U-T-L-E-D-G-E.
Oh, so British publisher and another Western
company. Well, yeah, British-American. Yeah,
cool. No. So who else, what other Flashback people are in that book?
Let's see. B.B. King. And then my Rolling Stones piece is in there. Aretha Franklin, who we both adore, she's in there. And who else?
Have you had contact with any of these folks in more recent times? Like Aretha's still going, and so.
No, we haven't. But we still love her. We still love her, and she's still great. A friend of ours went to see her at the Apollo a couple months ago and said she was fabulous.
Oh, good. Oh, good. The other person, though, a totally separate book. Is you became not really obsessed, Ray Charles. Yeah.
Ray Charles. I wrote a full-length biography of Ray Charles called Ray Charles, Man and Music. Came out in 1999, and now it's out in an edition that I wrote a new ending to cover his through his death,
well, yeah,
unfortunately.
Yeah.
And that's a very good book, and that's got well-reviewed, and it's out there. That's Amazon or your public library or Barnes & Noble.
And it was an authorized biography?
No, it wasn't authorized, but I did interview Ray several times. And I had cooperation of his staff, and they opened the doors for me to interview just about everybody.
Oh, that's good. So how was it not authorized? I mean, that sounds pretty...
Well, there was no money deal, and he didn't review the manuscript before publication.
Even better. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was better because, I don't know if you know the expression, to be a Raylette, you have to let Ray, but Michael interviewed a lot of Raylettes and a lot of non-Raylettes who were lady friends of Ray Charles, and I think... he has been an idol of mine, just the most fabulous musician and piano player since forever. And this doesn't take away from that, but he was not pleased that so many of his lady friends were willing to talk about his relationships openly, apparently. Yeah. Yeah, and that drew heavily on the book also.
Well, Michael, did you have to let Ray? Or?
I don't think he was interested.
But the movie was terrific, and the director, Taylor Hackford, then got in touch with Michael and was acknowledging how fabulous the book was and took us out to dinner. It was
very nice.
Very nice, yeah.
So let's have a Ray Charles memory, though, of talking to him or something that he told you that blew your mind. Or
well, I can tell you this. When he first made serious money, he bought land and he built a building that became his recording studio. Yeah. And I was there interviewing him there one day. And at the same time, there was a photo shoot. And so the photographer had all these lights with the big umbrellas and all that stuff, and they were clicking away and the lights were flashing. And suddenly, all the lights in the building went out because they had so much surge of power, they had knocked out the lights. So Ray, of course, couldn't tell that the lights had gone out, but he heard people talking and said, "What's that? What's that?" Oh, and someone said, "The lights have gone out." Ray said, "Well, I'm the one who fixed that." He got up from where he was sitting, walked through this tangle of wires, into the control booth for the studio around the corner, just like in this radio station, opened up a utility closet, reached in, felt where the little door was for the fuse box was, felt down, felt one of the switches had gone out of place, flipped it back, the lights came on, he came back, and the studio set, and the photo session continued.
Wow.
He was the most intelligent human being I've ever met. He was truly brilliant. He really was a genius.
Oh, my God.
And active and impatient and lively and vital. He was like a force of nature. Interviewing him, he'd be rocking up and down his chair. He'd reach and grab you to laughing just to make a point. Wonderful man. Wonderful man. Tough intellect.
And Michael tells in the book things which I think to anybody who studied piano like I did, fascinating stuff about how he was blind and he was learning how to play classical piano. So he had to learn, he would read the Braille for the right hand with his left hand while he was playing it with his right hand. Then he would read the Braille for the left hand with his right hand while he was playing it with his left hand. And then to play it, he would have to memorize it to play both, because it's a hand thing. And the other incredible thing, well, many fascinating things in the book, but he would write the arrangements for his band. Of course, he's blind, so he had to dictate it. And musicians know that the different instruments are in different keys, so that to write music for a whole band, all the parts are in different keys. They have different numbers of sharps and flats. many people, many composers and arrangers will write everything out all in one key and then fix it how it's supposed to be. He would dictate from his head in the appropriate keys for all the instruments. To me, that is absolutely mind-boggling.
And never make a mistake. He would say he would never have to correct an arrangement. Once he had imagined it in his head, dictated it, that's the way it was.
So he could hear all the instruments, and he could also relate to the fact that they were all in different keys, so that what's a D on the piano has to be an E on the tenor sax, and it has to be a B on the alto sax, and place those all in his head and line them all up, what's up and down. I mean, it's just fabulous. Yeah.
And then on breaks from recording and working all this stuff out, play chess blind.
Oh, come on.
And beat the pants off everybody who came into the room. No, I'm not kidding.
No, I know you're not kidding. That's just amazing.
Yeah. He had sets of chess men, and the white ones would have flat tops, and the black ones would have pointed tops, and he would just feel them in the dark and play, and he was a killer chess player.
Fantastic. Remembering Ray Charles here with Michael Leiden and Ellen Mandel. Michael wrote the book, Ray Charles, Man and Music, which is still available from Amazon. And again, to find out more about Michael and Ellen and their music and to get their CDs, first of all, you can go to one of their websites, or both of them, ellenmandel.com, Mandel with one L, Michael Leiden, LYDON.com, or some of their CDs aren't available on those sites, so you might have to go to Amazon or CD Baby. So might as well tell us also about a couple of the CDs that you guys have.
Go ahead, Al.
Well, something I'm very excited about is songs that I've been writing based on E. E. Cummings poetry.
Mm-hmm.
I've always loved E. E. Cummings poetry, and a friend of ours who sings, actually a tenor, sings in the San Francisco Opera Chorus, sent me four of his poems at one point to set to music. He wanted to do a recital, and I got started with that, and it really took off nicely for me. He loved what I did, and I was very excited. So I've written now 18 settings of E. E. Cummings poems. One of my CDs is all E. E. Cummings poems. It's called A Wind Has Blown the Rain Away, which is the title of one of Cummings' poems. And if we have time to play it, there are one of the most famous poems that he wrote is called Buffalo Bill's Defunct. And I've written a song based on that. Maybe we'll play it over the radio now.
Yeah, Buffalo Bill's Defunct, but we're still here.
Good.
It's gone
by. Yes, we're hoping.
Playing a composition with words by E.E. Cummings, music by Ellen Mandel, and there's vocals to this
and
by Todd Almond.
And the vocals are Todd Almond, yeah.
Here we go with a little E.E. Cummings.
As the sky, deep as the sea, wide as the world, my love for you, your love for me, forever will be. Love day after day, night after night, year after year. Clouds will brew, cold winds will howl, we'll lose our way in rain and darkness, then morning will come, we'll still be together, so don't be afraid, don't shed a tear, kiss me, my sweet. Here in our hearts, in heaven above, forever love.
Hi, I'm Michael Leiden.
And I'm Ellen Mandel.
And we're in the neighborhood of Dave's Gone By on radio station
WGBB.
Welcome back to Dave's Gone By. We're getting musical and having so much fun with history and memories of music, as well as new music being composed by Michael Leiden and Ellen Mandel. It's been wonderful to have them here. I've got about 400 questions and only time for a couple more. But I want to go back to Michael again, looking just through your amazing bio and the fact that you were part of the whole 60s and 70s scene and writing not only for Rolling Stone, but for Newsweek. You were a correspondent at one point?
Yes, I was. But, yeah.
So you were covering, if not directly involved, with the civil rights movement?
That's right. Well, that was for the Boston Globe. The in the 60s, for me, the hippie stuff and sort of peace and love was a parallel thing with the civil rights movement. The Stokely Carmichael, Bob Moses, John Lewis, these were fellows just like the Beatles and the Stones, guys exactly my age, big ideas, passionate belief in what they were doing, amazing ability to communicate their passion, and I loved it. The idea of freedom now, of one man, one vote, stand up, respect yourself. I'm an Irish American, not an African American, but all those ideas I could translate into myself. Just like Bob Dylan inspired me, Martin Luther King inspired me to grow into the person that I really could be, to stand up for myself. Curtis Mayfield, wonderful composer, keep on pushing. I'm so proud. I internalized that and took it over for myself. Yeah, I'm going to do the same damn thing.
Were you at the March on Washington? Or were you?
I wasn't. I was working that summer in a newspaper in Dayton, Ohio, but the preparations in Dayton to go to the march became my beat, and a couple of ministers told me, well, you know, we're only going because you've been calling us up and asking why aren't you going, that we got shamed into going.
Good for you. And sorry to sidetrack, but again, you know, we talk about the Beatles and we talk about the Stones, and you mentioned my favorite singer-songwriter of all time. No offense to you guys. You're somewhere on the list, I guess, but Bob Dylan, have you ever brushed with him, talked with him, anything?
No. Ah. We went to a bunch of his concerts in 74, which were fabulous. But, I think he's a great, great artist, no question.
Who were the influences on both of you, as far as musically, both growing up and even when you write now? Who do you listen to, or who were you listening to?
Everybody. Everybody. Ray Charles was a great, sure, great idol of mine. Aretha Franklin, but also classical music of all kinds. I studied classical piano, so Beethoven, Chopin, Bach. I mean, but now anything that comes along. I held off against rap for a while, but I've even gotten to starting to like that. The new, you know, salsa, Latin, and then now listening to world music, anything that you sue and endure, and you know, you hear it, and it's just, there's not enough time to listen to everything that's out there.
There's so much good music, and there's so many good musicians, and if you listen, you may not like it at first because it's not what you're used to, but as soon as you hear that inside all that music is a person trying to beam their deepest feelings and their deepest ideas to the world, you just have to admire them and fall in love with them. It's great.
We live in Manhattan in the East Village, and our little corner store is run by some people from Bombay, or Mumbai, as it's now called, and they have music playing all the time in the store, which is fabulous. It's their Mumbai pop rock or whatever it is.
Yeah. And it
you
sounds
just go
Indian
in there, and it's just so great, you know. So it's all wonderful.
Now, when you guys work, quote-unquote, I mean, do you get together and say, oh, I want to write a song about this, or is it always either a commission or there's always a play that needs stuff, and that's what gets you going?
Well, for me, it's so great when there's a commission, because there's nothing like somebody wanting you to write something and then knowing that you're going to have it performed by excellent people. But sometimes stuff just comes out of your head. I have a new CD that'll be coming out, and I wrote a song called Clouds, which is it's about remembering people who are gone, basically. That really just came from my soul, that I had just wanted to write a song like that about the angels that I knew in my life. You know, so sometimes it comes from a commission, sometimes it just comes from inspiration.
And Michael, same
thing. Most of my songs really have come from practicing on the guitar and I'll just be doing an exercise, and but two notes, three notes, a rhythm, something will say, hey, that's usable. A lot of those go no further, but some of those grow into songs, and that's wonderful moments. I just thank God for them.
How do you work it out, though, as a couple? Let's say you're working on something, one of you, and you kind of want to do it alone, and then the other one's tromping around the house and hears you, and, can you say to that, no, this is my song. I'll have you sing on something else.
No, yeah, I think we're very good about that. Michael is, when I'm writing, like, one of my coming songs, which is just kind of my thing, he's the first person to hear it, and as it's coming together, I'm always hoping he's going to hear something and go like, oh, that sounds good, honey. What is that? And I go like, I don't know what it is. I don't want to let the cat out of the bag, but it's a major part, and a lot of good ideas come from hearing each other.
It really does, and for me, often I'm writing at my desk, and Alan's piano music is wafting from the next room, and it's a great, great pleasure. I think we both inspire each other, and I know that I learn a heck of a lot from this gal.
Well, he says that about my piano music, but I have to say that I was working on Medea, the play Medea, which is a very, very dark play, and the director who I adore to work with, Eve Adamson.
Formerly from Cocktail Rep.
That's
and
right,
now
from
she,
the
what
Cocktail
call?
Rep, and now she's working with the Phoenix.
Phoenix, right.
Yeah, and I'm working with them. I've worked with her there, too. But working this Medea, we had long, you know, maybe 8, 9, 10 minute scenes that I was underscoring with synthesizer. And there, you know, when Medea is calling the dark spirits up from below the earth, it's kind of creepy and strange. And so Michael was like, well, this isn't the usual beautiful music drafting. He'd be like, ooh.
our daughter was home at that time, and we were both sort of huddling in the bedroom like, what is this strange stuff coming out of her, Ellen?
She's like, Mommy and Daddy are having weird sex tonight. Speaking of which, 25 years, is that what keeps it together? Is that your connected?
I for myself, I just, it's the greatest blessing in the world to have met this beautiful, darling girl, I can tell you.
We're very lucky. We're very lucky. Very lucky if you meet somebody that you can get along with and have fun in all different arenas, and we won't go into details. And
please do. And it's Sunday night. We can say anything.
We can say anything. And
involves handcuffs, doesn't it?
At times. I mean,
taser guns.
There's just no holds barred, so to speak.
Good for you.
But it's nice, and if you can still, you know, we just enjoy talking over everything, and it's just very, very lucky.
When you first met, was it like love at first sight?
Yeah, yes, it was. And actually,
we've got a song, Dave.
Gee, wow. Isn't that serendipitous?
It's my song. We both sing on it. Love at First Sight.
Love at First Sight with Ellen Mandel, Michael Leiden. Please go to their websites. I want to thank you guys so much for being in the Daverhood.
Thank you for letting us in. It's been really fun.
It's been Love at First Sight with me and you guys, too.
Absolutely.
Here we go with the title track from Love at First Sight. Love at First Sight.
One night in June, big bad moon, Chinese lanterns twinkling bright. Now what was the tune that big band was crooning? Must have been love at first sight. We danced till three on the balcony. Dawn put the stars to flight. On this subtle breeze, whisperingly, must have been love at first sight. By now we've had a while to look each other over. We've seen what time can bring to lovers. That night at the lake was no mistake. The years disappear when you are my dear. Oh, darling, that that was the tune that big band was crooning the night it was love at first sight. At the lake was no mistake. The years disappear when you hum in my ear. One night in June, big fat moon, Chinese lanterns twinkling bright. What was the tune that big band was crooning? The night it was love. The night it was love. The night it was love at first sight.
Hi, I'm Ellen Mandel.
I'm Michael Lydon.
And we are here with Dave's Gone By on WGBB.
And thank you so much to Ellen and Michael for being with us on Dave's
Gone By. Who the heck am I?
I'm sorry, what?
Who the heck am I?
We're just on the radio for the last 40 minutes and playing some nice music and really telling some wonderful stories. And by the way, speaking of something wonderful, Mets win!
Celebration!
Well, I mean, so far, it's now tying up 2-2 in as far as the series goes because the Mets won the game 12-5 tonight. Big bats coming through.
Yeehaw.
Finally. Yeehaw. And not a terrible performance by the starting pitcher, which is exactly what we kind of needed. He got through a few innings and got us to middle relief.
A nice Jewish boy.
Speaking of relief, want to be relieved by... No segue there. I'm just going to thank our sponsors, who are Hewlett Minuteman Press,
MortgagesRock.com,
and Performing Arts Insider Theater Magazine. Please go to PerformingArtsInsider.com to find out more about that, because it just gets better every month, and they keep expanding it and stuff. And
Fancy... And who writes that?
Oh, a bunch of people. And who runs Fancy Schmancy Balloons?
I do.
Oh, so if people wanted to contact Fancy for their party, for their... weddings, bar mitzvahs, christenings,
balloon arrangements across the country.
For their Ramadan fast breaking and bombings. Well, where should they go?
How about for Halloween?
Oh, that's right.
They're beautiful.
Ooh. And they want to be balloonatics. How do they contact you?
Well, get the fingers to the little, punching those little buttons.
Mm-hmm.
Punch the 5 first, and the 1, and the 6. Then the 7, and the 9, and the 7. Then the 3, the 2, 2, and the 9. So that would be...
516-797-3229. The only reason I remembered that is I wrote it down. 597-3229 for Fancy Schmancy Balloons. Couple of reminders for everybody. Catch a Vintage Dave's Gone By episode every Thursday and Saturday night now. Two nights a week.
Are my episodes vintage yet?
If they're older than 2 weeks, vintage.
Vintage.
The rot sets in and it becomes... kind of cauterized and...
A rock sets in.
Rot. The rock. Not the
rot. The rot.
Mortgages rock. I rot. It's kind of a different thing there. Anyway, Saturday night, Sag 11, and Thursday night,
Sag
11.
Don't you give me the hand.
Talk to that. Now, it's the hand that's moving your microphone down. DFSX Radio, listen on the web by my website, davesgoneby.org. Now, happy Simchas Torah, everybody.
Woo! Hooray!
So happy Simchas Torah.
It's time to change those Torahs, so don't forget to turn your Torahs back.
get the new Torahs, the ones with, you know, the ones on microfiche.
You know, today's the Simchas Torah is when we read the last portion of the Torah.
And we start the new one all over again.
And we kind of just actually did that. That was very fun, didn't
they? Exactly. Well, we had nothing else to do.
It was fun.
But also we were listening to the wonderful Ellen Mandel and Michael Lydon. Please go to their websites. Please buy their music. Nice people. Really interesting people, as you heard.
And
they've written some good songs.
Tell them Love at First Sight.
Love at First Sight.
Kind of the way I'm feeling right now.
What?
Kind of like the way I'm feeling right now.
Aw. Well, I mean, granted, he sings a little like Tiny Tim in the lower register.
Ooh.
But he writes a nice song. I'll tell you, I'll say that. Anyway, for more stuff, I'm not sure if it's going to be musical or whatever, we've got some amazing guests coming up, including Barry Levitt, who is the former head of the MAC Awards, the Manhattan Association of Cabarets.
Did he build Levittown?
No, he did not build Levittown. Oh. He may have lived there at some point. But he is also former head of Lyrics and Lyricists at the 92nd Street Y, so I'll be asking him about that. Then coming up, the Halloween show, which looks like it's going to be totally packed. It's also your birthday show.
You know, I think it's very rude of Halloween to preempt my birthday show.
Well,
we're going to have my, what is it when your birthday show is late?
Anyway,
my belated birthday show.
Coming on that show will be, too, a return guest. We've got His Mighty Robot, the band that's going to stop in for just a little bit because I've got a new CD out, and Michael Largo, the author of a really amazing book about death, called Final Exits. Perfect for Halloween. Two really cool Halloween things. Among the other folks coming up in weeks ahead...
For my belated birthday show, who's on? Come on. Daphne?
No, that's not on your birthday show. That's going to be the week just before Les Mis opens. Daphne Rubin Vega is going to be a guest on Dave's Gone By. Tony nominated. I think she was in Anna in the Tropics and Two Sisters and a Piano off Broadway, and of course Rent. Now she's playing Fantine in Les Mis, but she will be on this program in a couple of weeks, as will Improv Masters TJ and Dave, and I'm a different Dave, here with Jeff Goodman. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. I will be back, and I'm sure Jeff will be with me next Sunday, October 22nd, with the 193rd edition.
Will that make our 200th edition in January or December, Dave?
We were working on that last week. I'll have to get back to you on that. Of Dave's Gone By.
It's taken over a week to figure this out, and still he's in a quandary.
It was a busy week, and I was sick, so. Thank you, God, for making me better. Okay, there's another thank you. Until then, don't miss your days going by. This is Dave Lefkowitz wishing you love at first sight. Well, E.E. Cummings, but I'm a-going, and...
Gone By.